My next guest on Saturday morning is British economist and political journalist Grace Blakely, who takes aim at capitalism itself in her latest book, Vulture Capitalism: Corporate Crimes, Backdoor Bailouts, and the Death of Freedom. In the book, Blakely asserts that rather than failing, capitalism is working exactly as intended, allowing corporate and political elites to advance their own interests at the expense of the rest of us. However, instead of feeling powerless, she proposes a path for hire, the radical left-wing politician Tony Benn, and is flattered to be described as TikTok's answer to him.
That was probably the highest praise I've ever received from any publication. Tony Benn was kind of a celebrity in my household growing up. My kind of parents and grandparents were socialists, and he was always like, you know, their favorite politician. So I absolutely loved hearing that. And I actually met Melissa Benn, his daughter, the other day at a literary festival. And she said to me, "I hear that you are TikTok's answer to Tony Benn," which was slightly embarrassing. But yeah, I mean, I think it's the best possible praise you can give, because he was just one of the most effective democratic socialist politicians in recent memory, in my opinion.
And the book itself, Vulture Capitalism, you argue very much that capitalism is working exactly as intended. Do you think that would come as a surprise to some people?
Yeah, maybe. You know, I was really trying to take aim at this argument that you find a lot nowadays, which is that, you know, the problems with the system that we have at the moment is that markets aren't working as they should do. You know, perhaps there's too much inequality, or, you know, traditional economic models haven't accounted for the impacts of climate breakdown. And then one way or another, all you need to do is kind of tweak the system and maybe try to change some policies, change tax rates. You know, this is the famous kind of Piketty argument: wealth inequality goes up over the course of the history of capitalism, so we need a wealth tax. And I really wanted to show that actually these things aren't perversions of capitalism. They very much are inherent to the way that a capitalist system works. And the reason for that is that we have this assumption that states and markets, politics and economics, are these two separate spheres, right? And if you have, you know, more state spending, for example, that means you have less market, and vice versa. So there's this idea that you can kind of expand state planning in order to account for the failures of the free market. And equally, you know, if the market isn't functioning particularly effectively, because let's say there's monopolies, then you can change the structure of the market using political tools to make it work better. But my argument is that within capitalist economies, politics and economics have always been kind of merged. And actually, there isn't this clean separation that you might think that exists in practice. And that just means that it's very hard to actually just use policies to try and change things. And, you know, a really good example of why this doesn't work is just the massive lobbying power of big, you know, large institutions that are able to kind of use the state to meet their own interests. And I use a lot of examples of what this kind of fusion of political and economic power looks like in the book. But one that's particularly topical at the moment is the example of Boeing. So listeners may be familiar with the 737 MAX disasters, in which two Boeing planes plummeted out of the sky. And it was eventually revealed that senior executives at Boeing had known about the problems with this plane. And there had been all these kind of, you know, cutbacks in its development, and an attempt to kind of maximize profits and boost the share price. And the FAA, the regulator, had basically not delved too deeply into this problem, because it was under this, you know, principle of kind of self-regulation. So it kind of seems like, oh, this is just the free market gone mad. But if you look deeper into this case, the American state was really, really deeply involved. So Boeing was one of the biggest recipients of corporate welfare in the US at the time. It got loads of tax breaks and subsidies. Moreover, a merger that had taken place with Boeing and another company had been facilitated by the American state. And then when you had the pandemic, this was after the 737 MAX disasters, that was used to just pump even more public money into this massive multinational corporation, which is also a massive arms dealer and really deeply imbricated with the American state. So it's not like regulators are going to stand up and say, oh, you know, let's regulate this more effectively, because their interests are so aligned with those of this corporation. So my argument is really, we need to democratize all of these systems, if we're going to get accountability, we can't just rely on the idea that the state's going to protect us from the market or the market's going to protect us from the state.
So the free market and competition, essentially, you say as well in your book that we think of these things as being separate, but actually capitalism is quite highly planned.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is, I think, this idea, again, often promoted amongst kind of libertarian thinkers and even those on the right, that the problems that we're seeing today in terms of inequality and, you know, a lack of kind of competition in certain markets are all just down to the fact that there are large, powerful corporations that basically aren't being kind of disciplined by the market sufficiently. So they would agree with large parts of the analysis that I presented in the previous answer and just say, well, markets have been corrupted because the government's intervening too much, or corporations have become too big. Some of them might argue that those corporations need to be kind of shrunk down in size by competition authorities to make the market work more effectively. But the issue is that there is this inherent tendency for corporate power to grow over time. And there is that tendency is kind of not separate from the power that is wielded by politicians. You know, corporations get bigger, they're able to spend more money lobbying, getting politicians on their side, and then they're able to shape regulation in their favor. And that's actually something that has been observed, you know, for a very, very long time, is the way that the pressures of competition actually end up undermining the very principle of competition. And you can kind of try and enforce antitrust here and there, as we're seeing at the moment. But ultimately, once the system has been captured by the largest and most powerful institutions, there's really no coming back from that. And you see this, you know, with the case of big tech, for example, now. The regulatory structure has been so permissive for so long that there really is kind of no going back. These corporations need to be transformed from within, as well as changing the structure in which they're operating. And that's kind of what I call for in the book. It's like really just ordinary people organizing in the places that they work, in, you know, their communities, on the streets, to basically try and take back control of these really powerful institutions. And what's interesting in the case of big tech is that actually there are a lot of workers forming into unions, and not just the kind of workers on, you know, low pay that you would expect to be in unions, but across the whole system, who are organizing within these institutions and are trying to kind of shift the way that they work.
There are a couple of historical examples I'd like to talk to you about, because they felt quite striking, I suppose, to me sitting here in New Zealand in particular. One is about the East India Company, and we'll come on to that shortly. Mm. But Henry Ford is a really fascinating example I found in the book of capitalist planning, and actually had much more far-reaching effects than I realised.
Yeah, I use the example of Ford to show that planning has remained fairly constant throughout the history of capitalism. So big businesses and states have always worked together to kind of determine who gets what, but that the nature of that planning has changed over time. And this is the kind of central argument in the book, really. It's that capitalist systems are planned systems. You know, there's always some level of central planning that takes place among big monopolistic corporations and large and powerful states working together. But the way that that planning plays out is determined by the balance of power in society. So if you look at the Ford Motor Company, it's really interesting. It kind of emerges as this really big and powerful monopoly, because at first it's the only company that's really producing cars. And it has this enormous planning power within American society. It's got very, very deep links with the American state. And then I look in the book at one point, Ford tries to create his own rubber plantation in the middle of the Brazilian rainforest, in the middle of the Amazon. And kind of ships out lots of kind of American managers, puts them up in a little mini American town, and tries to get them to encourage the local workforce to start harvesting rubber. It doesn't work, but it shows the kind of extent of Ford's ambitions to plan, and indeed to kind of project his power and relatedly American power all over the world. And back at home, you know, he had this fairly, you know, pliant workforce that wasn't particularly well unionized. And he took a really ruthless approach to beating back any unionists that did try to organize. Now, what started to shift after the Second World War, during after the Second World War, was that organized labor became much more powerful within Ford. Eventually, the union was recognized. They won a series of victories. And after the end of the Second World War, organized labor became a kind of accepted institution within the American state. So Kennedy sets up this thing called the Tripartite Commission, which is a way for bosses, workers, and politicians to come together to try and, you know, mediate disputes and basically decide on policy issues. And for a while, you see basically labor incorporated into the planning process in a very overt way. And this, you know, changes the way Ford works. It changes the way American society works. And what you see is the growing kind of anger amongst bosses, people like Ford, including Ford, who was furious at the idea that workers would, and this was a different Ford, obviously, furious that workers would be allowed a seat at the table. So, you know, the leaders of American industry really like sponsored and got involved with this movement that was aimed at pushing back against worker power. Now, this movement that you may or may not know, that your listeners may or may not be familiar with, is referred to as the neoliberal movement. And the way that it's framed is this idea that, you know, the economists and politicians that were involved in it said they want to kind of expand free markets. They want to shrink the state because the state had too much power. And it was kind of, you know, undermining people's freedom, and that the only way to restore people's freedom was for a return to free market principles. So privatization, what they call deregulation, tax cuts for the wealthy, etc. And what I argue in the book was that actually that free market turn was never really about freeing markets. It was never about reducing the role of state planning. It was just about excluding workers from the planning process. So planning continued as it had before, as it has throughout the history of capitalism. It's just that rather than workers, bosses, and politicians, the workers were pushed out, and it was just bosses and politicians that ended up planning. So under the guise of this free market shift, you see actually not necessarily a fall in the amount that governments are kind of distributing and spending. You see big tax cuts for large corporations. You see big subsidies for big businesses. You see not deregulation, but a change in the kind of regulation that we have, and the state becoming much more powerful in, you know, disciplining workers, in disciplining protesters, not really a kind of shrinking of the state at all, and a big expansion in monopoly power. And you see this again within the Ford Motor Company, which sheds a huge amount of its workforce, having defeated basically the labor movement within the company, and becomes, rather than a motor company slash financial institution that makes the majority of its profits from lending to customers to buy its cars. So this is a way of kind of extracting profits whilst having a smaller and more pliant workforce that ultimately brings Ford to the brink of really severe financial problems in the financial crisis of 2008. So this shift from kind of laissez-faire free market capitalism in the early 20th century, where bosses could do whatever they want, including Ford building a town in the middle of the Brazilian Amazon, through to the post-war period, where their power was much more constrained because of the role of organized labor, through to the, in inverted commas, free market era, which was actually just about excluding workers from that process. It really illustrates that point that planning always takes place within capitalist economies. The big question we should be asking is not about the size of the state versus the size of the market. It's whose interests are being accounted for when policy decisions are being made.
You're listening to Saturday Morning on RNZ National with Susie Ferguson. My guest is Grace Blakely. Her new book is Vulture Capitalism, Corporate Crimes, Backdoor Bailouts, and the Death of Freedom. Grace, I'd like to ask you about the example that you use of the East India Company. It's an example of capitalism working like state power. Now, of course, in New Zealand, there was the New Zealand Company, which was a similar sort of model in the first half of the 19th century here. Those overt links between capitalism and state are very much on show in those models, and was a driver of colonialism. But what is the legacy?
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book, I look at how this fusion of corporate and state power is generally focused on basically expanding empire. And this comes back to the origins of capitalism, really, around the time that the East India Company emerged. And it emerged as this kind of joint venture, basically, between a bunch of merchants and the British state, which were given free rein to kind of govern India as a state might. And a lot of theorists at the time, a lot of the earliest kind of political economists who were studying capitalism and saying this is a free market system, were really confused by this. Adam Smith called the East India Company a strange absurdity because it was a kind of a company in the guise of a state, basically. And this wasn't something that should fit within their model of how capitalism should work. But this was foundational to the development of capitalism. As you mentioned, we're not just talking about the British East India Company here. There were loads of different companies that were set up by states working with merchants to project imperial power all over the world. And that continues for a very, very long time. I look in the book at the example of Guatemala and the United Fruit Company. And this was kind of, in inverted commas, the original Banana Republic, where the United Fruit Company was able to control an astonishing amount of infrastructure within Guatemala. And when their power was threatened by a kind of, vaguely left-wing candidate for the presidency, the American military basically stepped in to make sure that didn't happen. So to protect the interests of the United Fruit Company abroad. And this is, again, this fusion of state and corporate power in the interests of expanding and promoting imperial power all over the world. And that continues today, not necessarily in kind of overt terms, in overt military terms. I look in the book at the system of international courts called investor-state dispute settlements. These are, the courts that within which these investor-state dispute settlements are kind of litigated. And these agreements, which are written into a lot of bilateral treaties, allow corporations to sue governments if those governments implement legislation or, rule in any way that undermines these corporate profits. And a really kind of famous and horrific example of this was Chevron spilling a load of oil in the Ecuadorian rainforest. And eventually, the Ecuadorian government, after hearing a case from people in the area who'd been seriously damaged by this oil spill, decided to force the company to pay up. And they then sued. This was originally Texaco and then was bought by Chevron, sued the Ecuadorian government in an international court, basically saying that, we're not going to pay these damages, we're not going to clean up after ourselves, fled the country and successfully sued the Ecuadorian government, forcing the people of Ecuador to not only pay to clean up for this oil spill that this company had undertaken, but actually to pay for the company's legal costs and damages as well. And these treaties are prolific today. There's lots of open cases that take place all over the world. And again, this is an example of corporate and state power being very much used because, powerful nations like the US, like the UK, will force countries to accept provisions that allow for investor-state dispute settlements if they want to have trade with those big, powerful economies. Why do they do that? So they can protect and promote the interests of corporations that are headquartered in those states. So this fusion between political and economic power, is often used to advance imperial objectives, generally to the detriment of the poorest people on the planet.
When we talk about planned economies, when we think about this sort of thing, sort of inevitably somewhere like the Soviet Union would spring to mind with communism. What is the situation with superpower economies around the world now, and where do they stand as regards planning?
So the thing that I look at in the book is the kind of similarities between all of those kind of superpower economies, because we're taught to think of the differences between, let's say, the US and China as being about one respecting democracy and free markets and capitalism, and the other one being an authoritarian you know, nominally communist society where the state plans everything. And, you know, to some extent, that is true. Like the US is a democracy and China is an authoritarian system. But as regards to the economy, China does have a significant amount more centralization of kind of economic decision making within the hands of the state. But there's a huge amount of centralized planning that goes on within the US as well that undermines its claim to being a truly free market economy and actually often really undermines democracy. I mean, you only have to look at, say, the influence of the massive fossil fuel companies over American democracy to understand how this corporate power kind of corrupts and corrodes the democratic system within that country. There was a Greenpeace reporter went undercover a while ago with a lobbyist that had lobbied on behalf of ExxonMobil, who was bragging about all of the wins that they'd had in lobbying American senators and congresspeople, and said that they had been lobbying for a carbon tax on the basis that it was the best way to undermine the green agenda because it was seen as a tax on ordinary Americans. And obviously, these companies were the same ones that are promoting this idea of the carbon footprint. So they're trying to kind of avoid any collective responsibility for climate breakdown, despite the fact that companies like ExxonMobil have known about the greenhouse gas effect since the 1970s. Their scientists uncovered evidence for it back then. But they are trying to kind of shift the blame onto individuals and lobby governments to avoid any, you know, regulation of the fossil fuel companies or excessive taxation of those companies. And that is, you know, undermining the fight against climate breakdown, it's undermining democracy, and it's undermining markets and how they should be functioning as well. And, you know, America will often, American statespeople, statesmen and policymakers will often kind of chide China for its role in undermining the fight against climate breakdown and undermining decarbonization. But the US is also a massive polluter whose democracy is being eroded by the extraordinary power of some of these big fossil fuel companies. So there are similarities here when you look at the fusion of public and private interests in service of basically kind of augmenting the power of those at the top. And my argument is that the real divide in like world politics, in, you know, in different kinds of societies, isn't a divide between market-oriented and state-oriented societies, because all economies sit somewhere on this this axis between, you know, pure market and pure state. You never have a pure market economy. You never have a pure state economy. All of these economies, all capitalist economies, have a certain amount of state planning. They all have a certain amount of market competition. They all have a certain amount of monopoly power and market power amongst the biggest corporations. It's, you know, kind of a mishmash, right? The big difference in societies is the extent to which power is centralized or decentralized. And in a country like China, power is extremely tightly centralized among a group of bureaucrats, heads of large companies, wealthy individuals, you know, people in municipal government. And power is very, very tightly controlled. Equally, within the US, power is highly, highly centralized among a small number of powerful politicians, regulators, corporate executives, financial executives. And the opposite to both of those societies is actually a society in which power is decentralized. And I look at lots of different examples of movements that have sought to challenge corporate power, that have sought to challenge kind of concentrated state power, and really sought to take power back for ordinary people. And that's really, I think, the only way that we can start to imagine a different kind of system. We can't just carry on with this debate of more market, more state, because it's used by those at the top to obscure the real terms of the debate, which is whose voice is actually heard in the decision-making processes, whether that's the decision-making process in a government or in a big multinational corporation. And if people aren't organized, whether that's organized in unions or organized, you know, to make political change in political parties, then their voices are going to be ignored. Mm. So there's a whole section of the book at the end where I look at how ordinary people can come together to organize to make their voices heard.
A lot of people will be listening to this and thinking, so what is the answer? If capitalism has, you know, resulted in rampant consumerism and toxic individualism, what power do ordinary people have here? And how do they leverage it?
Well, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is that nobody's coming to save us. And I think the kind of culture that we have, this individualistic culture that you mentioned, the kind of celebrity culture, encourages us to think about politics as something in which the majority of people are passive and there's one active person who's going to come in and save everyone. And this is common to progressives and it's common to those on the right. You know, when people who feel disempowered and angry about the state of the US, say, put all their faith in Donald Trump, they're looking for a savior. They're looking for someone to come and save them and make them feel better about themselves. Equally, for progressives, there's often this sense that we just need to elect a couple of good politicians and then everything will be fine. We just need to get a government elected and everything will be fine. What I'm arguing in the book is that nobody's coming to save us. If we don't organize and build strong and cohesive political movements, build strong and cohesive labor movements, build power in our communities, then politicians are simply not going to listen to us because the forces that are working upon their decision-making processes remain the same. Corporate power will still be a massive factor in determining, you know, legislative outcomes. Lobbyists will still have a huge amount of power, and not just over politics, but over the media, and the media then influences politics. So the system is very cohesive. And unless we're able to build counterpower of the kind that existed in, say, the post-war period when unions were much stronger, then not much is going to change. Having said that, the moment that people start to actually take part in movements and try and really challenge the authority of those at the top is the moment that you start to see change kind of snowballing. And I think a big part of the reason for that is that we do live in these individualistic societies where people are encouraged to think of themselves as like isolated, atomized individuals just competing against one another in these market settings. And not cooperating. So, you know, today, if you can't put food on the table, you are probably going to, you know, blame yourself. Maybe you'll take out a high interest loan to try and make ends meet. And, you know, you're just going to be in the situation where you feel like you failed, and that's going to have a really big impact on you. If you look back, you know, 50, 60 years, if you were in that situation, you would have spoken to your coworkers and said, I'm not getting paid enough. I can't afford to feed my family. What are we going to do about it? And then you would all work together, cooperate and organize to demand a higher wage. That's a very different way of understanding a society. One is like, I'm just an individual and everything that happens to me is my fault. The other one is I am a part of a movement and I'm going to organize with those around me to try and build a fairer world. And I really think that we need more of that collective consciousness if anything's going to change. And what I'm really excited about, this is the good news, are all the incredible movements that demonstrate that kind of collective consciousness. And participation in those movements completely changes people. It improves their mental health. It you know, makes them feel less lonely, makes them feel part of something, and politicizes them. So even, you know, just local community level organizing, there's lots of examples I use in the book of, for example, there's a village in North Wales where a bunch of residents came together and just started setting up community enterprises to try and provide employment and alleviate poverty. And eventually they set up their own community energy company because there are all these foreign energy companies working in the area and not providing any benefit to local people. So they set up their own community energy companies and dealt with issues like fuel poverty and, you know, started a series of food banks, started to build up these community spaces. Eventually got the notice of the Welsh government, and this model kind of just kept growing as a challenge to the extractive kind of model of neoliberal economics, basically, which had dominated before. And it really challenged that and transformed the local area and gave people a sense of hope and like a political mission that allowed them to organize and build this out. And it did kind of really radicalize people and gave them the sense that there is another way. And I think those kind of local experiments, whether it's in community organizing there, whether it's in workplaces, in the book I look at the example of the Lucas Plan, where workers in an aerospace company that manufactured weapons came together and developed a plan to take over the firm, make it a worker-owned organization that would produce socially useful commodities rather than just weapons. That happened in the 1970s. All sorts of examples of people coming together and just challenging the power of those at the top from the ground up. And when you start to see lots of those those movements emerging, they can really start to build into something bigger and more powerful that can begin to challenge the status quo. And, you know, you've seen this a number of times all around the world recently. Obviously, there's lots of challenge to any movement that seeks to really kind of redistribute political and economic power in any society. But when you have those strong movements that are rooted in human relationships and in a sense of collective power, they are very, very difficult to defeat. And ultimately, they will find expression in our in politics and will be the only things that will actually allow us to confront corporate power, to confront corporate greed, to confront political corruption. It's that people need to organize and demand a different world rather than expecting someone to come along and do it for us.
Because people, as you're saying at the top, don't give up that power easily. When we look at New Zealand, there are 14% of the New Zealand workforce in trade unions. That's the latest figures of 2022, which was up 3% on the previous year, which feels like quite a significant jump.
Mm.
However, how to galvanise people to pull together to demand what you're saying is a better world? How to do that when, you know, 14% of the workforce in somewhere like New Zealand seems like a very low level of engagement?
It is a very low level of engagement. And, you know, what we haven't talked about so far is that the reason that the neoliberal movement, this kind of free market movement, was so successful was that people felt as though from the 1980s onwards, they didn't really need to participate in trade unions. It wasn't just that states were kind of beating unionists down. They were doing that. But because there was this massive global economic boom, all built on debt, basically, and financialization, people felt, oh, my house is constantly going up in value. I can get, you know, relatively low interest debt. The economy's growing. I can, you know, my wage is going to carry on increasing. People kind of expected this to happen forever, basically. People really stopped believing that there was any need for collective organizing at the same time as the, you know, the global economy boomed. The tension between those at the top and those at the bottom seemed to ease because everyone felt like they were, you know, they were becoming better and better off. Now, that all started to change with the financial crisis of 2008. People started feeling more insecure. They started to see their living standards fall. And that is something that has accelerated ever since then, because we've had, you know, in a lot of different countries, austerity, political elites responding to that crisis by basically blaming ordinary people and forcing the cost of that crisis onto ordinary people rather than those at the top. And, you know, just a whole slew of global challenges, from climate breakdown to, you know, the crisis in the global food system, to geopolitical conflicts, to all sorts of different stuff that are making a lot of people worse off, making people poorer, generating these costs of living pressures. And that's why I think you're starting to see more people participate in the labor movement, and why you're starting to see people pour out onto the streets. The issue is that without a coherent understanding of the need to organize and what can be achieved by organizing, a fall in people's living standards will often drive them towards the far right. So people at the moment, I think all over the world, are experiencing a sense of decline, stagnation and decline, and they feel scared. And there are far right politicians who are exploiting those feelings to basically demonize and stigmatize certain social groups, often immigrants, and saying, you know, if we just put up walls, then everything will be better and be able to go back to that lovely sunny era before the financial crisis when everything worked. And that's a, you know, convincing message to a lot of people. It's just, we need to go back to a time when everything was good and nice. It's, of course, you know, a fictional message. That's, you know, not possible because of all the changes that have happened in the global economy, but it's compelling to a lot of people. And I think the reason for that is that progressives haven't really, like, been as successful in explaining and challenging this sense of disempowerment, of, you know, poverty that people are increasingly experiencing, of insecurity, and channeling that into political movements. If you know everything's going wrong, but you don't feel like you have the power to change anything, you're not going to become a progressive. You're probably going to go to the far right, which says burn the whole system down and, you know, invest loads of power in one super charismatic leader who's going to take on all the elites and, you know, like Donald Trump claiming to drain the swamp. But if you know things are going wrong and you are participating in political movements alongside other people who are also challenging the system and trying to change things, that's going to push you in a very different direction. And yeah, it is the root of how we build a different society. So, you know, how do we get there? Well, it's kind of why I wrote the book. It's why I participate in all the movements I participate in. And it's why progressives are all working all around the world, really, to try to turn this sense of disillusionment and disempowerment that is very pervasive amongst so many people into a challenge to the status quo, rather than something that just deepens the power of those at the top.
I read a review of your book, Vulture Capitalism, by John Arledge in the Sunday Times. It was a rather sneering review, but he said that your arguments amounted to pound shop Marxism, and I wondered what your response was.
Well, to be honest, if I'd had a positive review in the Times, I would have had to have a very long, hard look in the mirror. This is, you know, a giant media conglomerate that is known for basically its adherence to beliefs and to ideologies that are completely opposite to my own. It has been a long time, I think, since an overtly Marxist book on political economy has, you know, been published and made its way into the Sunday Times bestseller list, which is what Vulture Capitalism is. And I'm not surprised that, you know, people writing for the Sunday Times feel quite probably challenged and a bit terrified by that. They're like, this is a discredited ideology. You know, this person obviously wants to bring us back to the USSR. Why are young people buying all this stuff? And I think it really speaks to a kind of just cluelessness on the part of a lot of people in positions of power within our society, within the media in particular. You see it today, actually, with people kind of sneering at young people protesting against the war in Gaza, saying that, you know, these are just people who are joining up with any old political movement because they don't have a brain and don't really understand what's going on. These people are so comfortable and so far removed from the struggles of most people's lives that they don't really see the anger that's bubbling up, and they don't see the real challenge that is emerging to capitalist ideology, basically, to an ideology that was assumed to have been completely cemented in public consciousness after the fall of the Berlin Wall. There was this idea that Francis Fukuyama wrote that this was the end of history. Capitalism had won. There were no real ideological challenges to this system anymore. And so I think they treat any kind of dissent, any protest, any, you know, organizing amongst workers with kind of puzzlement and contempt, basically. And you see this with all the coverage of newspapers like The Times, of, you know, protesters, of labor movement organizing. There is a sense that things shouldn't be this way. People shouldn't think these things, rather than a curiosity as to why they do. You know, why are people organizing to, you know, resist low pay and poor conditions in, say, Amazon warehouses? Why are young people pouring out onto the street to demonstrate against austerity and demonstrate against, you know, the war that's taking, well, lots of wars that are taking place all over the world? Where is all this discontent coming from? And if you don't analyze the fundamental nature of capitalism, it's hard to see where that discontent is coming from. It's hard to see how all of these different issues, from climate breakdown to inequality to the erosion of democracy, are all connected in this critique of an individualistic, consumerist, greed-based society that is damaging our connections to one another, damaging our relationships with ourselves, and damaging the natural environment so deeply. So I'm not surprised. I'm surprised they even bothered to review my book, because in the past, the strategy would have been just ignore it. But when it makes it onto the Sunday Times bestseller list, you kind of have to at least have a nod to it. I'm not surprised that the people reviewing this book were sneering at it, because I think they just don't understand what this critique is, what it means, where it comes from, and how important it's going to be in the years to come.
And that is Grace Blakely, her latest book that she was talking about there, Vulture Capitalism, Corporate Crimes, Backdoor Bailouts and the Death of Freedom. She is a journalist and economist. Previous books include Stolen, How to Save the World from Financialization and The Corona Crash.